Who, me? Yeah, all right, good. I'll do a show.
That's kind of my thing.
Music's playing. Somebody call Ad Rock and tell them they got to change the name of this song to my theme. I don't know who this Ricky is. I guess it must be Ricky Powell. But anyway, it's my theme now, man. I think MCA would probably be cool with that. He was an anti-war guy. Anyway, so ask Mike D, see what he thinks. Ask Ricky. It's his theme, right? So, was. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, today on the show we're going to be talking about the wars. Bad wars. Also other things. We got great guests. You know what I didn't do? Whoa, capitalism followed me on Twitter. I'm going to follow capitalism right back. Hi, capitalism. You know what? I think I'm going to make sure I'm following this guy, too. He tweeted me some interesting things. Well, we'll get back to this in a second. People are so crazy. You ever notice how crazy people are? They're so out of their mind, insane about everything. Here's my website, scotthorton.org. Horton, like, here's a who. Sometimes people seem to think I don't pronounce my last name very well. Scott what? Morton? Norton? Wharton? What did you say? Was it? Is there a T in there? What? Yeah, Horton, like, here's a who. Same damn thing as that. Like the heroic paraplegic wheelchair pool skater. Like the awesome pro BMX biker. Like the even more heroic than the paraplegic wheelchair pool skater. The anti-torture human rights lawyer from Columbia University in Harper's Magazine. Just like that. In fact, the same first name as him, too. Oh, yeah, and all of them. Did I already say that? Yeah. Listen. The point is, it's scotthorton.org, and I keep all my interview archives there, all my whole show archives there, all the articles I ever wrote for anybody. I was getting started archiving the wife's articles on there, but I never did finish that. I got to work on that. And then, let's see, you can find, I say, my blog, which I'm about to write a blog entry about today's show here in a second. You can find documentaries I've collected, none of which I've made. But just that I think are good and you ought to take a look at, go to scotthorton.org/documentaries for that. Every book I could think of to recommend you, actually, that's not true. Every book I could think of to recommend to you about like 4, 5, 6 years ago, I went off that list and I haven't finished. I forgot about that, actually. I really need to finish building the bookstore, but it's 10 pages long of my recommended reading there at scotthorton.org/books. And by the way, you can also find links in the right margin of all those pages to all this show's sponsors. And it sure would be nice if you would patronize their various establishments and tell them Scott sent you. All right, now to write that blog entry. Today's show, Van Buren and Scott McConnell. Hey, cool, Scott McConnell's going to be on the show, it says here. I just wrote it. That's why it says it. I really like Scott McConnell. He's a former neoconservative, meaning he was a commie, and then he became a right-winger, and then he became a paleocon and a no longer a neocon. Very interesting. I'm not exactly sure what kind of commie he was, but he was some kind of leftist turned right-winger, fellow traveler with all of the worst of the war party, but now redeemed. I'm writing for the American Conservative magazine. The Middle East doesn't matter. That's our spotlight today on antiwar.com. And I know what you're thinking. Hey, didn't Justin Logan just write something like that for Cato the other day? Yeah, he did. And Scott McConnell mentions that and says, yeah, Justin Logan is right. The Middle East doesn't matter. That's what the article's about, is how smart Justin Logan is. So there you go. Not exactly original, but still right on. And easier to get a hold of than Justin Logan, apparently. All right. Next week, Matthew Ho is going to be back on the show to talk about the wars. So that's good. That's important. And, man, I can't get a hold of that Max Blumenthal. He's same as Doug Bandow. Max and Doug Bandow both are just such workaholics. They don't hold still for a second for me to ask them questions about the work that they did. you know, they finish writing the thing and then they're on to the next thing. And God dang it. One day in the glorious brave new future when we all just have chips directly implanted right in our brains, then I'll just kind of smack myself on the side of the head. I think that's how it'll probably work. You'll have to smack yourself on the side of the head to, you know, activate it. Doug, do the show! And actually, there won't even be a show because you'll just download Doug right into your brain. You won't need the show at all. What do you need me for? Just cut out the middleman. Download Doug. That is, you know, why I stay alive. I'm waiting for all that to come true someday. But those guys, man, they're hard to get a hold of. Patrick Coburn, too. Hey, Patrick, can you do the show? Sorry, Scott, can't do it. Hey, Patrick, can you do the show? I'm afraid it can't be done. Hey, Patrick, can you do the show? Sorry, I'm traveling. Hey, Patrick, can you do the show? Oh, I'm afraid I'm giving a speech. Hey, Patrick, can you do the show? Sorry, I'm getting shot at. Hey, Patrick, can you do the show? I'm back, but I'm on my way somewhere else. God dang. I think, you know what? The gods are telling me I need to quit doing a radio show and just go be a reporter myself. That's what I'm supposed to be doing here, maybe. And then you'll try to get me on your show, and I'll say, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I've got a deadline. Yeah. Anyway, so that's the show today. Peter Van Buren on Iraq and Scott McConnell on the whole damn Middle East in general. And I got a couple more invites out. I guess we'll see what happens, but probably not. You know what? Here's a good question for you. Who's good on Libya? Because the only people I know who are good on Libya are Nancy Youssef and Bell True and David Enders. David Enders. Maybe I could call him. But not really. Who else I know is good on Libya? I got a list here. Oh, Mel Freichberg. She's great on Libya, too. But here's the thing. They are all just basically straight reporters. And they don't talk about Libya unless they are in Libya or they just left Libya and they're reporting about, yeah, here's what I can report to you about Libya. None of them are the kind of people that you just get on to talk about Libya news. None of them are writing informed op-eds about it or anything like that. And that's what I need, man. Who is good on Libya? And countries at war all the time. In fact, I think you know, I'm hesitant to talk about just how horrible everything in Libya is all the time because I'm afraid that in a way that'll help amount to pressure for America to do something about it. Because, of course, if something's wrong, then the U.S. government, which always caused what's wrong, i.e., Libya, or maybe that's E.G. Libya, they have to fix it. They're America's the indispensable nation, says Barack Obama. Indispensable. Like, say, Al-Qaeda needs the local clean-shaven-chin military dictator overthrown so they can replace him with a jihadi war unending. They call on America. And where Bill Clinton said 100,000 Kosovar Albanian Muslims have been killed. And it wasn't true at all. Barack Obama only said 100,000 Benghazi Muslims will be killed if we don't intervene. Didn't even have a genocide that he had to stop. Just a pretended one that could take place. Better go ahead and preempt it. Preempt a civil war that ain't happened. Okay. Somebody else's country. All right, why not? And for the suicide bombers? Psh, okay. And now, you know, what they've done now is they've hired this guy, Hiftar. He's the CIA guy who's been hiding in Virginia all this time. The great Libyan patriot from Virginia. And he is now... At least give Obama credit for this. He's now reversed his 100% pro-Al-Qaeda, pro-Ayman al-Zawahiri and Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia policy, and he's now trying to hire the next Gaddafi to come in to be the clean-shaven chin military dictator to keep Al-Qaeda down. Huh. If only Obama could go back to 2011 and not do that regime change in the first place, huh? Guess he never thought of that. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. Oh, the George W. Bush dead-enders, man, I'll tell you. It's like Baghdad Bob all over again. And I don't know what kind of idiot you gotta be to be a conservative in the first place. What are you trying to conserve? Get the hell out of here. But anyway, there's a certain sect of conservative, those who forward every email they get without double checking anything or caring whether it's actually right or not. And of course, yesterday they were all going completely ape over a New York Times story that talked about American soldiers who were exposed to chemical weapons in Iraq, and it was covered up and they weren't treated. They got, you know, Gulf War syndrome all over again, just like the detonation of the Kamacia bunker in 1991. And all these guys exposed to chemical weapons, and the government does nothing about it. Chin up, drink a beer, quit whining. You got a psychosomatic disorder like a sissy, boy. No, they were exposed to sarin. Well, in this case, there's a New York Times report about American soldiers from Iraq War II who also were exposed to some of Saddam's chemical weapons. And, of course, every right-wing idiot with an email account is forwarding this around as though this is somehow proof that George Bush was telling the truth that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction in 2002 and 3. Talked about this yesterday. Well, of course, if you just read the damned article, it explains that all of this stuff is vintage 1980s. 80s. The latest they ever made anything was 1990. George H.W. Bush bombed the crap out of them in 1991. Their nuclear program, their clandestine nuclear weapons program, was exposed and completely destroyed. Which, not that they had gotten very far, so don't get it wrong. And their chemical, whatever chemical and biological weapons were, and programs were completely dismantled. Except for they tried to hide a little bit of mustard gas, but they got caught. By the end of 91, they were caught. It was all destroyed, and whatever wasn't destroyed was still declared and isolated and placed under lock and key, and some of the stuff they figured was too dangerous to destroy, just let it decay past its shelf life, and sit out there in the desert. And that included, yes, some uranium, which was all put in IAEA storage lockers under lock and key, all, declared and all accounted for, and no mystery about it. For, ready, 12 years leading up to the war in the name of the stuff. It was all accounted for. And I told you the story yesterday about Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, Hussein Kamel, who defected in 1995, who gave up everything, who was completely debriefed by all relevant agencies, including CNN, and told his whole story, and how then Saddam panicked and turned over every scrap of paper he had to the inspectors because he didn't know what Hussein Kamel had taken with him. And so he didn't want to be caught withholding a single document. So he ordered his government give him everything. And they did. And all mysteries solved by 1995. That's it. Anything left over after that was a rounding error. And then, so the guy who asked me yesterday, hey, Scott, what about this? People are saying this proves George Bush is right. Well, he got back to me this morning on Twitter and says, well, here's the response from, I guess, his Facebook page or whatever, copied and pasted, and it's the same mythology. Oh my God, they had all this uranium. Oh my God, look, mustard gas. Look, this is all from the 1980s. This is all from when Ronald Reagan was backed by the United States of America. It was mostly European chemical weapons, but paid for by the Americans. You want to know a funny story? I'll tell you a funny story. One time, I was driving down the road, and I heard somebody call Rush Limbaugh's show. And he said, hey, Rush, the FBI could have stopped the first World Trade Center attack. All you got to do is read the New York Times from October 28th, 1993. And I said, and then Rush Limbaugh hung up on him, and I'm surprised they didn't even just delay it out of the broadcast altogether. But that was it, but he got the date of the New York Times article out. So I was actually on my way to junior college at the time, and community college, is that the same thing? I think it is. I dropped out, so I'm not really that educated. I don't know. But I went to the library, and I looked it up. There it is, October 28th, 1993. The FBI knew all about the bomb plot. They had an informant inside the bomb plot. They pulled him off the case, and then Ramzi Youssef came in and replaced him, the mad bomber who ended up killing six people and almost succeeded in toppling one tower into the other back in 1993. And but here I was, is 96 or something, 96, 97, something. Internet's slow. I was looking at the microfiche, at the old school, like, you know, like I'm some old man, not online. And I'm looking in there, and there was an obituary. First of all, there were two obituaries in there that I just happened to come across in that same issue of the New York Times. One of them was from a doctor who helped run all the MKUltra attempted mind control experiments and torture and sensory deprivation to death. Can you imagine? Sensory deprivation to death. That's how they murdered some of these people. You know, just experimenting with the human psyche, and you don't have a right, so they can do what they want with you because they're the government. Anyway. So he died and had an obituary in there. And then there was another guy who died, and he was the whistleblower. He had an obituary in that same New York Times, October 28th, 1993. He was the whistleblower on the case that all of the farm loans to Saddam Hussein were being spent on chemical and biological weapons. And everybody friggin' knew it, but he was the guy who called the attention to it. And I don't know if anything actually was thwarted or stopped, but, anyway, fun little anecdote. Everybody knew that it was American money that was paying for that. And as I told you yesterday, there's a brand new article, last year, by Matthew Aid at foreignpolicy.com, all about even, really exploring in depth the amount of cooperation that the Americans gave Saddam Hussein in targeting the Iranians for using the chemical weapons on them in the war. You know, all your plausible deniability ain't plausible at all. It's true he got his conventional army from Russia. It was a bunch of old junk when he got it from them, mostly. Fourth largest army in the world, my ass. But anyway, yes, America did help back him and helped him use his chemical weapons on unarmed Iranian conscripts, under 18, most of them, a bunch of kids. No problem whatsoever, man. That's the American way. Everybody knows that. But back to the real point, is anytime any idiot goes, hey, look, they found a dud shell under the dirt in the Iraqi desert somewhere, and that proves that George Bush wasn't lying, somebody who says that doesn't know what George Bush had said and what his government had claimed. Because what they claimed was that there were active programs in developing and stockpiling and preparing to deploy chemical and biological weapons against the West. He could hit London in 45 minutes. With what? Nobody knows. He could fly his balsa wood and string airplane across Jordan, across Israel, across the Mediterranean Sea, maybe, I guess, take a shortcut over Spain and Portugal, and then across the Atlantic Ocean, and in order to spray you with germ weapons. So seal your house in plastic sheeting and duct tape. They said that he was friends with Osama, that he was going to give his sarin gas to Osama to use against your mom. That's what they said. We can't let the proof come in the form of an actual attack. We can't wait around for that. An unknown that might materialize. We have to stop them. They were lying. They were lying about every bit of it, right down to the cartoons of the mobile biological weapons labs. The cartoons, you know, in lieu of photos. Hey, Al Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Hey, regarding the First World Trade Center bombing, read that October 28th, 1993, New York Times report by Ralph Blumenthal. That's pretty much the whole damn story right there. Just like the caller to Rush Limbaugh said back in 1996. That's the story. A former Egyptian Army intelligence officer came to the FBI and said, man, I'm hanging around some really bad dudes, planning some really bad stuff, and I've made it so that I'm actually the guy in charge of making the bomb, so maybe we can work something out. You guys can pay me a little money, I can be an informant, and we can stop this thing. And the agents said, great, yeah, let's do it, hell yeah. And they started running them, agents John Antisev and Nancy Floyd. But their boss, Carson Dunbar, was not a skull and bones Illuminati Jewish CIA agent, blah, 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 like in your stupid belief system. He was just a stupid FBI pig, is what he was. A stupid, meathead FBI pig who wasn't interested in a bunch of Islamic this and that crap because he wanted to be the hero on the case of the Italian mob. And he told them, blah, 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 I don't want to hear about all this, and I don't know, and he was just like what a FBI pig boss you should expect to be. And he ended up saying, when the guy asked for a raise from $300 to $500 a month, he said, no, only if you wear a wire. And he said, what, I'm going to wear a wire where I'm sleeping on the floor of the mosque with these guys? Are you absolutely out of your mind? Well, no, forget you then, screw you then, because he was a pig. Not because the skull and bones and the Israelis made him do it, because he was a stupid pig. His name is Carson Dunbar. Yes, he should be in prison. Six people died because of him. Because the inside guy who was going to switch out the explosives for an inert powder and make a fake bomb and have a great bust ended up leaving. He told the rest of the guys, sorry, I think the FBI's on to me. I gotta go. And he split. And they brought in Ramzi Youssef, the evil killer terrorist murderer who built the bomb and killed the people. So if that's an inside job, then inside job means jerk me off. Inside job means anything. Like New World Order. New World Order means every day the sun rises and the order in the world is a little bit different. Do you see? Isn't it new? It doesn't mean anything. If inside job means they had an informant and then they blew it, then it doesn't mean anything. Sorry, chat room. But that shit just pisses me off. Jesus Christ. Wouldn't you rather be right about the First World Trade Center bombing than try to pat yourself on the back about how everything is a big conspiracy and you and all your stupid truther buddies who tell each other how right you are about everything get to pat yourselves on the back some more? We just recruited a new person to our religion. Doesn't matter if you're right or not. But why don't you actually read about the First World Trade Center bombing? Why don't you read A Thousand Years for Revenge by Peter Lance and actually learn a thing about it? Instead of going, inside job, dude, what about Building 7? All day. Carson Dunbar belongs in prison. Carson Dunbar is guilty of some kind of, you know, negligent homicide. I'm not the lawyer, Scott Horton. He's the lawyer. But if you ask me, the FBI supervisor who refused to do his damned job on the case of the First World Trade Center bombing, yes, should have absolutely been held accountable. Like, very, very accountable. And just imagine if that plot had worked and the first tower had toppled over into the second, knocked them both over, broken from the bottom, and fell over. Holy crap. And at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, when they were both full of 50,000 people. That's what they almost succeeded in doing. Can you imagine if that's how the Bill Clinton administration had begun? Holy crap. No one would have even minded the Waco massacre. They'd have just been like, forget it. I mean, Jesus, there's a war we going on now. But anyway, yeah, and then what ended up happening is the guys who actually did the World Trade Center attack, they ended up being prosecuted for a plot to bomb the UN and the Holland Tunnel and the Lincoln Tunnel because the Department of Justice couldn't be forthright about who all was in on the plot to bomb the World Trade Center and how they knew it. That's how guilty these guys all are, is they ended up prosecuted. I mean, it was a real plot to bomb the tunnels in the UN, but they prosecuted them for that. Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, Egyptian Islamic Jihad and all his buddies, Ali Muhammad and whatever, they got prosecuted not for what they'd done, but for what they had been planning on doing, because it was that much of the FBI's fault. So why does it have to be an inside job when the truth is enough that the FBI ought to be absolutely abolished and the Department of Justice and, for that matter, the entire national government with them and replaced with an entirely new safeguard for our security and liberty? Oh, no, the Jews hired the CIA to hire the Illuminati, to hire the Russian FSB to... That's really good research you did on YouTube there, dude. Why don't you try reading a book? Read a book. Have you thought about reading a book? Well, I was doing research on YouTube all night one night, and now I know how the world works. Yeah. Spare me about how much of a coward I am that I'm afraid to admit the truth that you learned on YouTube. Sorry. I shouldn't talk about how much I hate truthers on a show like this, because it just attracts them. CIA now is trying to undo their Libya policy. They fired their sock puppet, General Khalifa Haftar, to come in to be the new Gaddafi. Which, hey, not that it's the right thing to do, but it's better than backing Al-Qaeda against Gaddafi. They're hiring a new Gaddafi, and it's not working. It's not working. I don't know how the hell Gaddafi held that country together, but it's another one of these big fake countries. It's only existed since World War II. It's Tripolitania and Benghazi land, whatever the hell. I forgot the name of the eastern one. Starts with a C. And really in the south is a whole other country too. And he didn't have much of an army. I guess he just had his personal Gestapo, and he had, you know, all the right people paid off and bribed off and counterbalanced just right. But boy, all the king's horses can't do a damn thing with this thing. I don't think Libya will ever exist again. Already they have two competing parliaments and jihadi militias running around everywhere. And what George Mitchell is going to come in here and strike a deal where all these militias turn in their arms and shake hands and join the national army together? Whatever kind of fantasy the Americans have dreamed up here. And, you know, I was conceding yesterday that I was wrong when I was predicting that America would have to be in there training up a new army. I mean, they did try for a little while, but then they bugged out and left. They got attacked. They got sacked in the middle of the night. Their base got sacked in the middle of the night. They left. I thought there would be a full-scale nation building. I thought there would have been a full-scale nation building attempt in Libya by now, and there's not. But then again, I gave myself a little leeway because I said we're going to own it for the next 20 years. So that means the owning it can kick in any time now. And when you look at, obviously, what is a CIA plot to put this guy Khalifa in power, right? Khalifa Haftar in power right now. I think that ownership's already begun. Again, with the rolling start. But just look at the politics of the empire. What are they going to do? They're just going to let Libya fester as a failed state terrorist wonderland forever? I mean, I guess so. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying trying to do anything about it could work. I very much doubt that it will. Like I said, the state's at least going to be split into three if there's ever a state there again. It may just be stateless militia land from now on. Fourth generation warfare from now on. Westphalia over in Libya. But I forgot what I was going to say. Because the music distracted me. I'm going to blame the music for sure. It's a freaking mess. Oh, I know what I was going to say. So the escalation's only just begun. And I think under the precepts of the empire, they're going to have to try to do something about it, whether it'll make any sense to try to do so or not. That's what I was going to say. All right, more after this.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
It really is. It's a fun experiment in confirmation bias here, this weapons of mass destruction thing. And I mean, for me, conservatives are just by example. I don't mean by definition conservatism, but by example, conservatives to me are just the most intellectually dishonest people. I mean, them and liberals. But they're just, you know, I don't know. So the guy on Twitter keeps sending me the reaction of his pro-Bush people, and they just love this, you know? He hid them. Oh, your excuse, yeah, but they were getting old, is not really mitigating. Well, how about he declared them? How about the UN knew all about them all along? Is that mitigating? How about the assertions were not that he may have buried some old mustard gas shells somewhere that are worthless 25 years ago? The argument was that he has warehouses full of his stuff. He's making more and he's gonna kill you with it. And he's making nuclear bombs. These same guys are saying, yeah, they found uranium too. They found it, huh? You mean in IAEA lock and key storage lockers where it had been sitting for 20 years? Yeah, good find. You wonder why Saddam went to buy uranium from the French in Niger, which never happened, when he had warehouses full of it right there in Iraq. Under IAEA lock and key. But whatever. Ooh, you know what conservatives like? Factoids out of context that make them seem right. That's how we got into the Iraq war in the first place. Well, I heard that one time, possibly, Saddam Hussein's intelligence guy met with a guy that worked for Osama back in 1996 in Sudan. What? Really? That's what you got? That's your case, that Saddam is tied to Osama? Oh, wait, here, let me pull Al-Libi's fingernails out for a little while. Let me put this screw in his knee. Hey, Al-Libi, you know anything about Saddam? Say Saddam and the pain will stop. That's how they got us into this war. Is these guys defending Bush now, believing lies that were furnished by the tortured. And the same people who say, torture does work, it gets valuable intelligence. So, therefore, all morality is off. Barbarism is our goal, because it works. And yet all it works at doing is coming up with lies to fool them into supporting wars that include the mass use of torture to justify even more war. And if you just go and look at Jonathan Landay's work at McClatchy newspapers, you will see that all of the torture was really about getting these guys to implicate Saddam right before the war and right after it started. Dick Cheney was desperate for new intelligence. Now, it would be a fair question if you asked me, Jesus, Scott, why can't they just make up pure lies out of whole cloth instead of torturing it out of some poor guy? I don't know. But anyway, starve this guy to death, freeze him, beat him, keep him awake for 2 weeks, punch him in the face 197 times, and dunk his head under the water until he's in the death spiral, and the doctors you've hired monitoring his oxygen level in his blood say that one more moment would lead to his permanent death, and go ahead and resuscitate him and then do it again a bunch of times, and then ask him, tell me again about your friendship with Saddam Hussein, and see what he tells you. I see four fingers. I see five. How many was I supposed to see again? Five fingers? Five fingers. That was what Al-Libi told his torturers. Saddam Hussein had an airplane fuselage that his police used to practice anti-terrorist operations. That was said to be a terrorist training camp where he taught Al-Qaeda terrorists how to hijack planes. Oh, how simple and easy it is sometimes. Tell me more about Saddam, the torturers said. Nuh-uh, they did have a massive, active weapons of mass destruction program to create chemical and biological and nuclear weapons in order to sneak attack the United States and kill us all. And the proof is that in 2014, the New York Times came out with a story about how in 2008, some soldiers found some buried old mustard gas shells in the desert that were bought for Saddam by Ronald Reagan and, guess who? Donald Rumsfeld. Special envoy to Saddam Hussein. Like Bill Hicks said, Saddam Hussein, Iraq, they got incredible weapons, incredible weapons. Well, how do you know? Well, we looked at the receipt. But what time is that bank open? 8? What time is the check clear?
Bank opens at 8. We're going in at 9 for God and country. And hey, look, a fetus. Look, everybody, a fetus.
Same old thing.
Yeah. Oh, for Christ's sake. You people and your... I'm sorry, I'm addressing the chat room for a second. You and your false dichotomies. You and your light switch thinking. This is like arguing with third graders. I'm sorry. My official story of 9/11 doesn't come from the 9/11 Commission report or even the government, which, by the way, their official position is that if only they had done their jobs, they could have stopped it. That's the official position, by the way. But anyway, I never even read the 9/11 Commission report. My official story that I believe so much, as opposed to knowing so much like you idiots, is Peter Lance and Lawrence Wright and James Bamford and Loretta Napoleone and actual journalists who actually know things. Not David Ray Griffin, the theologian. Not the guy that proved that Jesus Christ not only came to North America to save the Mormons, but also went to South America. And he proved in his case for Brigham Young University there, who proved all the thermite bombs in your towers and all of your nonsense. My official story, I believe, like faith, is from wide and varied sources of real journalism, not a bunch of stupid crap. Like what you got. Oh, but I just don't understand how come Scott Horton is good on every single thing in the world, except he doesn't believe a bunch of stupid wrong stuff about 9/11 that I can't possibly make a compelling case for whatsoever. What's the matter with him? I bet the CIA sent him here to pretend to be good on 10,000 things. David Ray Griffin. Jesus Christ. What's the guy's name? What's the guy's name? The physicist who claimed that Jesus came also to South America. That proved all the inside the towers bombs. Oh, Gage. Yeah, here's another one. Richard Gage, who, the first thing he'll tell you is he endorses loose change. All four versions, none of which agree with each other about anything, and none of which are right about a single fact at all, other than that the attack happened on September 11th. They got the date right. Here's a physicist, supposedly. Here's some engineer who immediately gloms on his entire argument with a bunch of raving lunatics. Oh, and in the case of loose change, little children who have no idea what they're talking about whatsoever. Oh, yeah, Flight 93 landed safely in Ohio. Okay, guys. That's your engineer, huh? Richard Gage, the lunatic. Not even lunatic. How about stupid ass? How about braying jackass? Give me a break, dude. My friend Gordon Prather makes hydrogen bombs for a living. And I think he knows a little bit better than Richard Gage. He's what you call an actual physicist. He can fuse hydrogen atoms together and kill your whole city. That's what he knows about physics. Anyway, I watched him argue with Craig Roberts. Craig, come on, man. And Craig Roberts like, dude, the Jews did it. Oh, my God. Yeah, Paul Craig Roberts got it all figured out, dude. All right. When we get back on the other side of this break, I got ISIS news. I got Peter Van Buren, and I got Scott McConnell. And I'm sorry, man, I'm going to regret all of my ranting at the truthers in the chat room today because this is the blowback. The blowback. You know, the consequences of real things that happen in the real world are sure to be horrifying. Anyway, stay tuned through this 6-minute break and then, 9-minute break, and then we'll be back on the Scott Horton Show.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves.
It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, I got Peter Van Buren to talk about the Kurds and the Turks. I got McConnell on all of them, the whole damn region, coming up on the show. Now, so this is stupid. I'm not going to waste your time on it, but I guess it's important to know, or not really important to note, but barely worth noting. They named the war something that no one is going to call it. Operation Inherent Resolve. You're stupid. Don't you hate Democrats? I just hate Democrats. They're the most despicable creatures on the planet. What is the matter with you people? Sorry, I know I'm overreacting just for a bad name for a war, but just call it Iraq War 3, or call it the ISIS War, or call it the ISIL War, or call it the War on ISIL, or call it the something. Call it the redirection again. Call it something that makes sense. The redirection back the other way because oops, or something. Inherent resolve. Anyway, sorry, I've already gone on too long. Next, White House says expired war powers timetable irrelevant to ISIS campaign. Resolution holds the presidents have a 60-day window to conduct hostilities without an act of Congress. That's actually not true, but then again, the author of this article may not have written that. That's a sub-headline. The War Powers Act does not grant any authority from Congress to the president. It is not a transfer of authority at all. It's a reminder to the president of the authority of the Congress, and it tells him that he can operate for 60 days in defensive response to an attack. But after 60 days, he's got no excuse. The Congress has got to come back together and authorize him to keep going. There is no question whatsoever that he needs authorization from Congress to start a war. If you want to argue about whether he needs an authorization or a real declaration or this and that, I guess I don't care about that as much. Although, when it's just an authorization, that is a passing of the buck. And allowing it helps the Congress to argue that the president made all the decisions. They just let him rather than they made the decision, which is, you know, really it's the same thing, but they get away with that semantically, as we saw with the war, Iraq War II. But anyway, the War Powers Resolution does not say he can start a war for 60 days. It doesn't say that. And he does write that here. Spencer Ackerman does. And maybe he clarifies further in the article, I don't know. But anyway, the reason everybody that the Barack Obama administration has cited the 2001 authorization to use military force against those who attacked us on September 11th and have cited the authorization to attack Iraq back in 2002 and have variously cited and called the War Powers Act irrelevant on this is because they have no authority to do this and they know it and there is no law, and if there's a single point to it, it's that they're proving that right now. And old John Boehner and Harry Reid, they took an early vacation so they would not have to vote on it. Did that get out over the summer? Did they talk about that? On your way to the beach, did you hear him say that Congress went home early so that there wouldn't be a question of them taking responsibility for this war one way or the other? Are you kidding me? I think it's okay to say this because I'm only paraphrasing the father of modern American conservatism, Russell Kirk, when I say all of Congress should be hanged on the Capitol lawn and started over, or maybe, hey, how about better not started over? How about they'll be the last Congress, that's it. Why do we allow these people to have legislative authority over us at all? No, really, that's a serious question. And yes, Russell Kirk said that about George Bush Sr. He said George Bush Sr., he's a war criminal. He should be hanged on the White House lawn. Russell Kirk said it, so don't SWAT raid me or anything. Google Russell Kirk. He wrote The Conservative Mind. He's the consensus. He's what the right believes. If any of them have actually ever read any books, then he's got a lot of influence. some of the books they've read. Anyway, because he's right. Because you know what? Russell Kirk was so conservative that he believed that there was such a thing as law. I know, it's ridiculous. I'll wait and for you to stop laughing your ass off about it. But Russell Kirk really believed that there really believed that apparently that there was such a thing as law. And so since George H.W. Bush was a mass murderer, butcher of women and children, deliberately and purposefully bombed their sewage, their water, their electricity, that he should be punished. It's a capital offense to be a war criminal. That's what the law says. That's not what Russell Kirk says. The War Crimes Act in America is a federal law. It's not even some commie baby blue UN treaty. It's a federal law. If you commit war crimes, that's at least a possible, depending on your prosecutor, capital offense to commit war crimes. All Russell Kirk was doing was sticking with what we all are raised to believe in America, in our government schools, is what makes our system so much superior to everyone else's. And that is that we don't have a sultan. We don't have a king. I mean, we back every sultan and king on the planet, but we don't have one. Our president is merely the chief executive of departments created by Congress and funded by the will of Congress, our representatives. He's just a citizen, just like us. He's just a man. He's subject to the law the same as we are. That's all Russell Kirk was saying, was that if George H.W. Bush is guilty of war crimes, then he should be prosecuted as such. Although it's true that when you talk about hanged on the White House lawn, that sounds like skip right to the point. But I think his real point was it was obvious to all. There was no question about it. He had deliberately targeted the sewage, the water treatment, the electricity in the first Gulf War. That's illegal. And when American judges and lawyers and prosecutors hanged the Nazis to death after World War II, they said that the supreme war crime was starting a war. That was the father war crime of all other war crimes. Come from the launching of aggressive war. Without a UN resolution, of course. Once you can get the French and the Russians to agree with you, then you can kill whoever you want. But that's the law. I'm not sure what Russell Kirk thought of that. I bet he probably didn't agree with that any more than you and me, that the UN has the right to launch an aggressive war. But anyway, I'm sorry I've wasted so much of this damn segment telling all this, but I guess I said something terrible about what ought to happen to the Congress, but I didn't really mean that. And everybody listening knows that. All I really mean is, like, who are these horrible bastards who are allowing the President of the United States to launch a war without even convening to authorize it in any sense whatsoever, to vote on it in any sense other than, a little bitty vote to fund the new, brand new, out of whole cloth Syrian moderate army that they're supposed to create over there. That's not even going to include the FSA at all. It's going to be all new, they say. They passed that. That's nothing. Anyway, so the president has taken us to war. He has absolutely no authority to do it whatsoever. He did the same thing in Libya 2011. And I know, in my own ears, it sounds like technicalitarianism. Like, yeah, who cares? Would it be right if they declared war? Absolutely not. It's just one more part of it that's wrong. It's one more part of it that's a problem. Because, just think of what it means in terms of setting the precedents. It just helps prove Dick Cheney and his lawyer David Addington's point that when it comes to executive power, there really is no law. Maybe that's what they mean by inherent resolve. This is all, as David Addington and Dick Cheney said, the inherent power of the president. Never even mind what Article 2 says. He is leader. He may do, and no one may stop him. And so what's Congress saying? Right. Go on ahead. Even if you're Barack Obama, and of course the Republicans love killing so much, go ahead. Even if you're the weakest president in generations, go ahead. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Be afraid, Ebola, you're all going to die of Ebola. Give me money for some reason or something. I don't know. That was what TV was saying earlier. TV was saying, Ebola, Ebola, Ebola. Give us some money. I ain't afraid. I mean, I do wonder if I'm going to die of Ebola. Dallas is only a couple hundred miles from here. And when it comes to the absolute ridiculous incompetence of the people in charge of containing this thing, Masha. When it comes to the competence of the people in charge of this thing, hell, I guess we might as well all blow our brains out, right? I don't know. Hang on a second. Sorry, I had to get rid of the damned dog. I like the dog, but it's just, you know, not good. She's snorting like a pig, and I'm trying to mumble about some stupid crap on the radio. Who cares about Ebola? That's stupid, man. You're not going to get Ebola. Let's talk about the war. Islamic State photos highlight ISIS's grip on Ramadi. Now, these are bad guys. This is Bill Rogio at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is a right-wing neocon think tank. On the other hand, you know, everybody's an individual, and this guy actually does write a lot of interesting stuff, even if I don't agree with his conclusions about the use of, well, the existence of the U.S. government, much less the use of its military power and whatever. But he is good on a lot of stuff and just, you know, covers a lot of stories. And so anyway, he says the Islamic State has released two separate photo collections detailing its presence in Ramadi, the provincial capital of the Anbar province. More than half of Ramadi is said to be under the control of the Islamic State. The photographs were disseminated on Twitter by Islamic State supporters after being posted elsewhere on the internet. The jihadist group has taken to releasing its propaganda via its supporters on Twitter, as the majority of its official accounts are continuously being suspended by the social media site. The photos bear the title of Wilayat Anbar, one of the Islamic State's 18 declared provinces. Sorry to any Arabs, I'm sure I butchered the name of that, but who cares? I'm a Texan, man. I don't know. What do I know about pronouncing all these towns? The first set of photographs shows Islamic State technicals, or armed pickup trucks, moving along a road into Ramadi. The photographs are taken in the 7 Kilo area, a neighborhood on the highway west of Ramadi near the Ramadi West train station. Other photos detail the group moving in convoys into the city with at least 4 heavily armed technicals present. Islamic State fighters are also photographed while manning a checkpoint in the 7 Kilo area to keep track of who is entering and leaving the city. And anyway, etc. Here's got some photos. So just a little bit of detail there in the continued lockdown of the Anbar province. Now, Fallujah has been flying the ISIS flag for quite a while now. You know, I don't know. Remember back in January when they first put up the ISIS flag over Fallujah, they actually took it back down. And it wasn't any battle. It was that the tribal chiefs were mad. It was their uprising. And they didn't want the Islamic State guys throwing up their flag and trying to make it theirs. Shades of the old war, right? Where Al-Qaeda is really just a small percentage of the Sunni-based insurgency, and they better not get too big for their britches or the chiefs get mad and they have to back down again. But now, a lot's changed since then, obviously. But then again, you know, it makes me wonder about the relative power still, and who has a good read on the relative power of the tribes and the tribal leadership, you know, as compared to the ISIS guys, because even if they are a small percentage, yeah, that's called the government. You know, it very well could be that they've got the place on lockdown and not even the tribes can do much about it at this point. But I don't know that. I'd like to know more about it for sure. You know, Patrick Coburn seems to think, well, let's see, Coburn and I guess Prothero agrees and Lande and I guess. Let's see, Dar Jamil. I think I got pretty good consensus among my Iraq guys on this show about that. That the Islamic State is in a much, especially Patrick Coburn, the Islamic State is in a much better position compared to the tribal leadership than, and say, the former Baathists and so forth, than they were back when under Zarqawi or in later incarnations there in 2006 and since then. Because now, I mean, they've come in as the beneficiaries of the massive civil war in Syria all this time. All this equipment, all these fresh new recruits, a lot of battle-hardened guys who've been fighting for years and years and years, with a lot of experience. They've got alliances with the generals. This guy al-Duri, who was one of Saddam's deck of card guys, the red-haired guy, they say, I'm trying to remember where I read this now, that he was always an Islamist. He was always kind of a bin Ladenite, wanted to be a bin Ladenite type influence on Saddam Hussein. And so his alliance with the Islamic State is actually quite natural, and he's brought with him some Baathist military commanders who have some real experience. And so you have, as Mitchell Prothero put it, you have a bunch of crazy school shooter types only under the command of Baathist military men who really know what they're doing. So, and then the other thing is the Islamic State guys have taken a lot of Baathist officers hostage, supposedly. They've taken a lot of tribal chiefs hostage, and they are very wary of the stab in the back, and their entire plan for the reoccupation or the takeover of Sunnistan in western and northwestern Iraq has, you know, had in mind all along the Anbar Awakening of 06 and 07 and how the tribal chiefs got sick of them and turned on them, and they want to make sure that that doesn't happen to them again. And that doesn't mean that they can necessarily make sure, but it means that they're trying very hard, they're being very careful, they're keeping that in mind. And it could be that they, you know, are doing a good enough job, I guess, in keeping all their chess pieces in place, like the hostages I talked about earlier, that kind of thing. And, you know, Lande pointed this out on the Bill Moyers show. And this was something that we covered on the show a little bit back when it happened. I don't think we interviewed anybody about it, but I think I talked about the news when this happened a few weeks back, where the Islamic State had massacred approximately 700 members of a tribe in eastern Syria that had tried to buck their authority. And, well, maybe this is even 5 or 6 weeks ago. And the Islamic State, they just massacred them all, dude. In fact, that may be the footage that I was thinking of the other day. If you go on Lively, if you want to see a horror show, man, go look at ISIS and their prisoners. It's pretty rough. But anyway, so they're working hard on consolidating that power, and they seem to be getting away with it. And the consensus everywhere is that the airstrikes aren't really working. I mean, I guess they're saying it's helping slow things down there on the border with Turkey in Kobani. But then again, as Jason was saying yesterday, it still seems that the consensus is they're fighting hard for this city. They want it bad, and they've already sustained heavy casualties, and they don't give a damn. They're willing to take them. They want this city. They're going to take it. Now, Turkish intervention could change that, or maybe sending in the airborne could change that, but otherwise, they sure look to be on a roll. You know, Patrick Coburn asks, what happens when ISIS moves to Aleppo and Assad goes to full-scale war with them? What's America going to do then? Bomb Assad? Or bomb ISIS? Or both? Might have to choose at some point. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Peter Van Buren on the line here. He's got a brand new one here at tomdispatch.com. 7 bad endings to the new war in the Middle East. The new war. I think that's what we'll call it. I like it. It's the same war, but still, we got to come up with some kind of name. What could possibly go wrong? Ask Peter Van Buren at tomdispatch.com. Whoa! You got a lot of background noise there. It'll certainly be running at antiwar.com tomorrow. Roll up that window, dude, or something. Are you on the freeway? Hey, Peter, you sound absolutely horrible. I think what I'm going to do is maybe call Peter on the phone. Hey, Peter, let me try one more time. Hey, there he is. Hey.
Great, Scott. How are you today?
God dang, what was that noise?
It's hard to say, but just a quick update for your listeners. My website, wementwell.com, appears to be under a denial of service attack.
Oh,
and so,
really?
Yeah, if you're not able to reach the site there, you can read my stuff, today's post, the one you're referring to, on tomdispatch.com, on Huffington Post, on truthout.org, and a lot of other places around the internet. But if you can't get directly through to my site, keep trying, or access the content on another site.
Oh, man, sorry to hear that.
Whoever's out there doing the denial of service attack, we'll keep looking for you.
Yeah, well, good luck with that, too. And I hope your server company's got your back on that pretty well.
Yeah, I'm using a server right in Fort Meade, Maryland.
They ought to have pretty bad security or pretty
good. Got a great deal on it. All I had to do was write my passwords down in the margins of my last year's tax returns. And,
right.
Anyway, we've got serious things to talk about, and that are the 7 worst case scenarios that I was able to come up with from Iraq. And I'll just warn listeners that there's only 7 because we ran out of space. It would be easy to continue and add to that list, but we can focus on those 7 today. And then as events continue to tumble into the abyss, we can always come back and add to them.
Well, I got 100 more, so yeah.
Yeah,
but so yes, yeah, certainly. Let's. The bulk of this article, Peter, is about the relationship between the Kurds in all the different countries and where they rely there in the region of Kurdistan, and especially their relationship with the Turks in the midst of all of this. So you can take it and run with it from there, please.
Sure. And this is not to discount the ongoing crisis in Iraq, and we'll circle back to that. But what I really wanted to do by talking about the Kurds and the Turks was emphasize that the conflict that the United States has kicked off now in the Middle East is very much a network, if you will, in the sense that you can't disturb or alter or shut down one node without necessarily affecting the others. And that's what's going on here. In a very brief summary, the United States, desperate for somebody's boots on the ground that aren't ours, has dramatically empowered Kurdish forces. Some of these Kurdish forces are in part of Iraq that everyone knows is Kurdistan, and some of them are in Syria. But some of them are also in a cross-border area that Turkey shares with both Iraq and Syria. That part of the world, the borders are quite artificial and quite porous. Turkey and the Kurds fought a bitter insurgency over the 1980s. 37,000 people died. And even though some European diplomacy put that problem under wraps for a while, the Turks and the Kurds are no friends of each other. And the
Well, didn't
Turks
they have a big war all the way through the 1990s, too?
It may have gone on longer, yeah. I mean, the idea
I remember reading back then, I think Noam Chomsky was the only one who talked about it, but he was just absolutely livid about all of Bill Clinton's support for Turkey in the midst of their massacres of civilian Kurds in that insurgency, counterinsurgency.
And that's an important thing because I've already been flooded. Apparently, the Kurdish supporters have been able to get through to my website today. Maybe they're the ones doing the denial of service, you know, who have accused me of siding with the Turks in a genocide against Kurds and all that. And I really have no position on who's right and who's wrong. I'm trying to explain what's going on as best I can to an American audience unfamiliar with these things. So that's an important.
Well, and right or wrong, mine was just a point of fact. I sure didn't mean to accuse you of none.
No, understood, but it's something that keeps coming up as everyone can't find new things to be polarized about. Bottom line here is that by arming the Kurds, the United States has frightened the Turks into digging in. And that's why you don't see the Turks interceding in the war in Syria. And that's why you do see the Turks conducting bombing operations against the Kurds. So you've got this situation that the United States has created all by itself of basically putting two of our so-called allies into conflict with each other. So the Kurds who are supposed to be fighting ISIS and the Turks who are supposed to be fighting ISIS instead are largely fighting each other.
Yeah.
And that's just one of so many of these, we'll say, unintended consequences, even though perhaps they could have been anticipated fairly easily.
Now, let me stop you there for a minute and talk about that before we move on to further subjects. It seems like not only is it kind of crazy for the Turks to be, you know, at least doing nothing about a crisis that is engendering a massive refugee crisis in their country, and which is completely upending their entire relationship with the Kurds, which has been at some sort of ceasefire. I guess the Kurdish leader Öcalan is in prison, but he's been negotiating this whole time, but has said that if Kobani falls, that's it. Negotiations are off. PKK goes back to war and all this kind of thing. And so it seems like not only are there massive negative, immediate negative consequences for Turkey right here, but even worse, they're squandering what could be a wonderful opportunity to come in and say, you know what? Yeah, we hate the PKK and we're mad at their friends in the YPG and whatever, but you know what? We hate ISIS more and we're going to come into the rescue of the Syrian Kurds this time, and it'll be, you know, a major plus in our negotiations with the Kurds. That, after all, I mean, Erdogan has been trying to negotiate relative peace with them, right, this whole time. And it's somewhat worked. And so in what could have been a great boost to the negotiations, he's done the exact opposite and completely blown them up. But it's not like he's going to be able to get rid of a fifth of his population. It's just going to be another horrible war if all peace talks are off and it goes back to war. And so what the hell is he doing? Peter, help me understand.
You know, the short answer is I wish I knew at the level of understanding that I could say, well, here exactly is the true story, Scott. I think it's a series of conflicting interests that Turkey is facing, and they are trying to figure out, well, which of these conflicting interests is going to be the one that we need to focus on. And I think at the end of the day, what Turkey is mostly afraid of is a highly empowered Kurdish fighting force on its borders that will inflame the Kurdish minority inside of Turkey and essentially create either an insurgency or an open ground war that Turkey will have to deal with. I think Turkey understood ISIS and perhaps does understand that ISIS at the present time has no great interest in Turkish territory. And Turkey, with the second largest army in NATO Europe, I mean, we leave the United States out, you know, is well in a position to secure its own borders against any kind of ISIS assault. But that isn't even going to happen. So I think the Turks have decided we got to go one way or the other. And the way they're doing is to say we are not going to allow a powerful Kurdish army on our border.
All right. Well, we got to take this break. When we get back, more with Peter Van Buren, formerly with the U.S. State Department for many years, author of We Meant Well, and writing at tomdispatch.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all, welcome back. It's Peter Van Buren on the show, formerly with the State Department, author of We Meant Well and the Ghosts of Tom Joad. And here he is at tomdispatch.com, 7 bad endings to the new war in the Middle East. And he said his own website is under attack right now, but usually you can find it at wementwell.com. And, yeah, maybe you'll be able to get through. I don't know. So we're talking about the new war and the Turkish-Kurdish conflict and what all that has to do with it. And here's something that's part of that, Peter, and that is that Erdogan still wants regime change against Assad far more than against Baghdadi, Assad in Damascus, far more than against Baghdadi in Raqqa. And it's supposedly, at least, America's enemy is ISIS in here, and yet all of our allies, the Gulf allies, the Israelis, everyone hate Assad more. And so
right.
These are the people that we're fighting, or they're not fighting with us, but they're our coalition against ISIS. So what gives?
There you go, Scott. I mean, for America's plans in the Middle East now to succeed, basically all these countries have got to give up their national goals in favor of ours. And that's not likely to happen. America thinks it can thread the needle on this. It thinks that it can pull out from Turkey, you know, some common ground and use that, from Israel something else, from Saudi something else. And it thinks it can kind of piece this war together by managing the common elements against the disparate elements. We'll see how that works out, but I think that it's impossible that it could ever succeed. At the end of the day, these countries are far from stupid and are very much aware of what they're doing and what they want to accomplish. The Turks have been at least passively supporting ISIS for a period of time against Assad. And it's important to point out that until very recently, really 2 months ago, that was exactly in line with America's policies. Our policy was to get rid of Assad. And so what the Turks were doing, which fit their national goals to get rid of Assad, in fact, dovetailed with what America wanted them to do, which was get rid of Assad. And, you know, ISIS was the devil that you know that you're going to have to work with. You know, then, since America changed its mind fairly quickly when it looked like Iraq was about to collapse 2 months ago, you know, the Turks were like, yeah, good for you to be able to change your mind on a dime, but the rest of us are a little smarter, and we're going to be looking at long-term goals.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure Netanyahu, all Obama has to do is just pick up the phone and say, actually, wouldn't you rather keep Assad? And then Netanyahu will jump, right?
Well, the Israelis are an interesting addition to this mix. And I haven't seen a lot of mainstream commentary on the Israeli situation here. But what's important to remember is that Israel, perhaps more than any other country in the world, does what it feels it needs to do in its own national interest. And that national interest is primarily what it perceives as its own survival. So right now, you can imagine the things the United States is saying behind the scenes to Israel to keep them from playing any part in all this, because nothing would unite Sunni and Shia Arabs faster than the Israelis getting involved in this in some way. I mean, yeah. The only thing the Arabs hate more than each other would be the Jews. So Israel, I'm sure, is being begged, coerced, paid off, whatever you want to imagine, to stay out of this. But the Israelis will only take that so far. If this war spills across the border, the Golan Heights, into their country, they will get involved. If perhaps they see an opportunity to snip off some part of Syria that they need to bolster their defenses, they will get involved. If any weapons of mass destruction that happen to be laying around Syria get pointed towards them, they will get involved. And at that point, really, you might as well be throwing a match into a bucket of gasoline. Things are going to go up. So yeah, keep an eye on Israel.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to note, too, that whatever the Israelis' policy is, I mean, I don't know about all their domestic policies. Well, yeah, a lot of those I do know also suck. But their foreign policies also are always the height of stupidity and irresponsibility from the point of view of the Israeli government. Every one of these attacks on Lebanon, every one of these attacks on the Gaza Strip, and never even mind the entire policy of the occupation, amounts to national suicide in the first place. And for them to for the Israelis to prefer anyone to the Ba'athist regime in Damascus is insanity. I mean, here's a guy who might as well have been an Israeli agent his whole life for all the trouble he's given them. And they want to overthrow him in favor of the bin Ladenites?
You know, you throw your hands up, Scott, because the United States seems to believe that the Mideast is something of a chessboard, and that there's a piece labeled Saudi and a piece labeled Israel and a piece labeled Iran and whatever, and that you can move these, that the United States has the ability to move these pieces around, and that they will behave in a expected fashion, and according to our will. You know, your remark just underscores the inherent complexity of all this. Let's take Iran as another example. The United States is somewhat bizarrely welcoming the Iranian intrusion into Iraq. Iran was behind so many of the problems that we faced during the occupation. And in fact, the commander of the Iraqi, the Iranian ground forces right now in Iraq, Suleiman, was one of the high value targets that the United States searched for, but never was able to track down and kill during the occupation.
Yeah, he's now, also the guy who picked Nouri al-Maliki to be the prime minister.
And, you know, what a funny world. Now, the Iranians, who had to kind of play it cool and stay below the radar, now overtly have military forces on the ground in Iraq. Their commander, who once was a wanted terrorist, is now coordinating with the United States. And, of course, that has to be happening at some level. We got rid of, the United States staged its own little mini coup and got rid of Maliki, but installed another Shia prime minister who's from Maliki's own party, who in fact was associated with Mali. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that that new prime minister is planning to choose a Shia militia leader as his Ministry of Interior.
From the Badr Brigade?
From the Badr Brigade. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, the Sunnis, as part of any kind of inclusionary government, at a minimum need to see the Interior Ministry and the Defense Ministry not given to a Shia, because those ministries have been used to suppress and oppress them for many, many years. Yeah. Not only is the new prime minister giving that, apparently giving that position to a Shia, he's giving it to a Shia with direct connection to the militias, which have been and are continuing to kill Sunnis. Again,
right, meaning not, just to clarify, meaning not fighting ISIS out on the battlefield, meaning murdering Sunni civilians.
Right, and what the militias are doing is saying, well, ISIS are Sunnis, and ISIS has occupied these towns with Sunnis in them, so therefore all the Sunnis there must be ISIS, and we better just kill them all.
Yeah, maybe they really do work for the Israelis after all. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, in many ways, they work for the Israelis in the sense that they're working for Israeli goals. At the same time, their actions benefit the Iranians. At the same time, the United States is turning a blind eye to all this, believing that their actions are actually benefiting America's goals. It just can't work, Scott. And the article that I wrote tried to break it down country by country and say worst-case scenarios. But, you know, every time I read the news, I wonder if I really drew out the worst-case scenario or whether there was a deeper pit that I didn't realize even existed.
Yeah, well, you know, I was telling everybody on the show yesterday about Ebola. That's usually never the worst-case scenario, so try and relax. Except, you know, with Iraq, that was worst-case scenario. That still is absolutely worst-case scenario, and it sure does seem to be playing out. And, you know, I can't predict the future either. I think you got... Certainly, you've identified many of the hurdles here, absolutely impossible hurdles. I mean, the one that you just mentioned is really what you're saying is Sunnistan has already declared independence and it's never coming back because Baghdad and all the land from there to Kuwait is ruled by the people who torture them to death with power drills. And so that's it. These are the people that Bush and Rumsfeld chose to run the country, and this is what they did to it, and game over. It's almost the end of 2014, for Christ's sake. We're not going back in time to fix this.
Nope.
It's over. It's done. I mean, there still may be another million left to die, but it's not going to be what it was before, that's for sure. Anyway, thanks for coming back on the show. Sorry for ranting at the end of your dang interview here.
No problem, Scott. The debate has been
reduced. Peter Van Buren, everybody. TomDispatch.com. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network live from noon to 3 Eastern Time on the weekdays. You can find all the archives at scotthorton.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Scott McConnell, writing over at the American Conservative Magazine. His latest is The Middle East Doesn't Matter. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good. Happy to have you on the show again. What do you mean the Middle East doesn't matter? The Middle East, I will have you know, is the most important thing that there ever was, right? Come on, what are you talking about?
No, I mean, it's possible, like, let's just say there's a little license taken in the headline, but it doesn't matter nearly as much as the attention we pay to it or think it does. And we don't really have any very good strategies or options for dealing with the problems there. So I think it would certainly benefit from what was called in another context many years ago, benign neglect.
Right. All right. Well, and well, certainly, no matter what, whether people are as libertarian as me or as conservative as you are or whatever it is, this certainly has to be part of the debate. I mean, the fact that the goalposts are as narrow as just how many people we should be blowing up per day and that kind of thing, you know, is really problematic when those aren't the only reasonable arguments to have. There are very many reasonable ones that are unfairly restricted to the fringes of debate. So anyway, yeah, I guess this isn't much closer than the fringes itself, this show, but I'd like to... I'm happy to give you the opportunity to talk about this where people
Well, yeah, let me go back a little bit. I mean, after World War II, the Mideast was found to have like the largest repositories of, you know, of oil, huge amount of oil. And the people who were running American foreign policy thought quite correctly, in my view, that it would be that I mean, they understood that oil was needed if Europe was to get back on its feet and become an industrial power again, and for the United States. And they thought it would be a disaster if, say, the Soviet Union got, you know, was able to control that oil. And so there was a foreign policy consensus that oil should be part of the world market and, you know, sort of, you know, part of the Western-dominated world economy. And I think we did some bad stuff to ensure that, like fomenting a coup d'etat in Iran in, you know, 1953. But, you know, I think it was reasonable to want to keep the oil away from, like, say, Soviet control. But, you know, that just isn't an issue anymore. There's oil all over the place. The United States is now an oil exporter. There's no outside power which is going to control the oil in the Mideast in any sort of way. So once you take away the oil, you're looking at a region in which there are not major powers. There's not major economic power or technological power or anything like that. I mean, it's not to say that there aren't, you know, things of significance in the region, you know, including like Jerusalem, which is a holy city for three religions, but... you know, there's nothing, we shouldn't be obsessed about the boundaries or the dangers there. And we're being played. I mean, like this group, Islamic State, can do some executions on television. And America thinks it's like a terrible major strategic problem for the United States, which it just isn't.
Yeah, I mean, they really have seized the worst part of Iraq. It's not like they've taken Kirkuk and Basra.
Yeah.
All right, well, so, yeah, now there's a lot there, but it sort of sounds like, in a nutshell, kind of what you're saying is the people running D.C. don't understand economics. If they did, they would have a point of view that would recognize all the wide and diversified sources of energy all around the world as a global market in the way that you describe it, where they wouldn't really have to worry for a minute about who controls it. I mean, even a price shock for a couple of days will work itself out. And in fact, with all the futures markets and whatever, was that you that mentioned that about how that works out in even the danger of price shocks? That prices might go up, but not too quickly because they already have a buffer there.
Yeah, I think one of the articles I linked to, Justin Logan's.
Logan mentioned that the other day. Right, exactly. There's a guy that I interview from time to time named Michael Clare, who is some kind of liberal or progressive, writes for TimeDispatch.com.
Yeah, and he's an oil expert, right?
And he talks about, he sounds more like a libertarian or a conservative in the sense that you don't hear him saying it's all about, you know, stealing cheap oil for the American consumer or anything along those lines, which is sort of, I think, the assumption of uninformed liberal types.
That's the old left-wing assumption.
Right, and yet for him, no, it's all about the prerogatives of the empire controlling those oil flows, controlling which states have which pipelines going which directions, and if we get into a fight with China, can we choke them off in a week or can't we, and these kinds of questions. What do you think about that?
There may be something to that, but I would hope that there isn't. You know, there doesn't really need to be a fight with China either. And if a fight to China, all kind of things come into play, including the possible nuclear weapons by ballistic missiles. So, I'm sure there are people in the Pentagon who think about that, but I'm not sure that's what drives the American Mideast obsessions. If you consider that what drives them is, media and people who pretend to care about the Mideast a lot. And a lot of it is Israel related. I would say, at least half. They're not talking about, choke points in China. And I also don't think that, there's sort of an inner strategy where the real deal is kind of thought out behind closed doors and everything that goes on in the media is a kind of camouflage. I think that, we've had terror originating from the Mideast, and we have this extremely strong attachment and maybe an unnatural attachment to Israel. And those two are kind of interrelated. And between the two of those things, they play an enormous role in the American consciousness. And it's not like hard to see why, because certainly 9/11 was significant and Israel is significant. But you can argue that these things are given inordinate weight by a factor of two or three compared to how objectively important they are to America's well-being.
Sure. Well, and of course, the oil companies, they prefer being the ones doing the pumping and the skimming on any given well. If they're American companies, they like that intervention on their behalf. I mean, I think overall they prefer stability to all this madness. But they certainly like being the ones pumping Kurdish oil as opposed to some French or Chinese companies in there when it comes to that. Just for profit's sake. And congressmen are a dime a dozen, so that's not really a problem when it comes to that. You look at all the think tanks, they're all funded by Exxon as well as Lockheed, correct?
That is true. I don't know how to break that. I mean, I've mentioned, I'm a little disappointed that Rand Paul hasn't been a little more playing a tune to a different drummer than he has been. But it's as if, ISIS figured out that if you can execute one journalist and have it seen on American TV, you can pull the whole country around by its nose, and I think they almost, encourage American intervention because it maybe fits into their narrative that they're the, true
defenders from the crusaders.
Defenders of the faith against the crusaders, because I think what they're selling locally wouldn't be that appealing otherwise, but if they can, have a lot of Muslims killed by American bombs, that probably helps them more than it hurts them.
Right. Yeah, it is an extremely frustrating thing. It took 9/11 for Cheney to exploit to get us into this mess. But then it takes the beheadings of a couple of journalists who, they're Americans and they're innocent. Yeah. They're journalists, for crying out loud, right? But at the same time, they put themselves in harm's way in a war zone and these things happen. And yet those are 9/11 attacks enough to bring us into this thing. Just a couple of videos of a couple of individual crimes like that, as horrible as they are.
Yeah, no, I mean, journalism has long been a dangerous profession. Sure, and there's, you know, a very good organization called Committee to Protect Journalists that's been active, as I know, for like a couple generations.
Right. I'm sorry, we've got to take this break, Scott. We'll be right back. And I'm sorry, I don't want anyone to think that I was saying those guys got what was coming to them or anything like that at all.
No,
I'm just saying it's not the same as an attack on an American city or something. Anyway, hold that. We'll be right back with Scott McConnell from the American Conservative. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Scott McConnell, former neoconservative, over there at the American Conservative magazine. And this article is entitled, "The Middle East Doesn't Matter." And now, Scott, what is this Israel that you mentioned, and what does it have to do with American foreign policy in the Middle East?
Well, I think if you talk to any member of Congress about what America's vital interests are in the Middle East, they would say, I'm not sure in what order, oil and Israel, and different ones. And we've treated Israel's survival as a core national interest, but we've also, that's been probably sort of moved over a bit, or and switched. It's so to support for Israel, right or wrong, or whatever Israel wants, which are pretty different things. I think Henry Kissinger once said wisely that we are committed to Israel's existence, but not its conquest. And but we've Israel has kept the West Bank and kept control over the Gaza Strip for now nearly 50 years. And we are, if anything, the American government is as deferential to Israel, or far more so than it was 50 years ago, 40 years ago. So what does that mean for the Mideast? It means that Israeli wishes are treated with enormous deference in Washington. You know, for example, after 9/11, Israel got the idea that the United States was going to strike back at someone. I mean, someone besides the people who did it in Afghanistan. I think they probably most wanted us to hit Iran, which had nothing to do with it. But they thought, Iraq would be like a good lead-in. And so there was this long parade of Israeli officials who, come on Face the Nation, Meet the Press, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, saying Saddam Hussein has these weapons. It's absolutely essential that they, attack him now. And Americans have gotten kind of accustomed to treating Israel as like the realist, tough guy guide who really understands this exotic, tangled, violent region, and to take our clues from what Israel says. Now, Israel is, it's sort of a democracy and sort of an aggressive ethno-state. It's both at the same time. And, for the Palestinians who live on the West Bank, it's pretty much an apartheid state, though it's not so in Green Line Israel. But, the American Congress and much of the American body politic has bought the pro-Israel thing hook, line, and sinker. Now, in terms of the Mideast now, what does that mean? Israel is, I think, one of the reasons why we're so hostile to Syria and the government of Syria, and why we treat the overthrow of Bashar Assad as like an American national interest, when Assad is kind of a sad, dictator of cobbled together a government of religious minorities and Christians and things like that, and is trying to hang on in a mostly Muslim area. But he's also allied with Hezbollah, which is allied with Iran, and Hezbollah is the one Arab army which has fought pretty well against the Israelis and, gave the Israelis I wouldn't call it a fair fight, but a decent fight. And so Israel wants Hezbollah to be, deprived of arms and cut off so it can, take it out more easily. And so Hezbollah gets its arms through Syria. So Syria has to be our enemy, you know, whether or not under any other calculation, Syria should be our enemy.
Yeah.
You know, and same thing with Iran. I mean, Israel.
Actually, let me stop you before you go to Iran there. In 2000, say, I think six, Ehud Olmert, yeah. the previous prime minister, he wanted to negotiate with Syria and Bush stopped him. Remember that? So, I mean, it seems like that would be based on a realistic assessment of Assad that, hey, he's the devil we know. And as far as even disputing the Golan Heights or anything like that, he's a devil who doesn't do anything to them.
Yeah, he doesn't do anything to them.
So it does seem, is it just Netanyahu who's just hell-bent on trying to weaken Iran so badly that he's willing to create a much worse problem on his own northern border when Iran is still on the far side of Jordan and Iraq from there, you know?
Yeah. I know there were nearly successful negotiations between Israel and Syria towards the end of the Clinton administration. I'm not as aware right now of the 2006 ones, because you mean they're right around the time of the Lebanon War. But, you know,
I might have the year wrong there.
Yeah,
maybe it was 2008. I mean, maybe it was more closer to the end of Bush.
In 1999, Israel almost got a deal with Syria. And they, you know, it's hard to say why it didn't go through. It's a complicated issue. It has to do with, you know, land and stuff, but also other things. If we go to Iran, I would say Israel's, you know, large strategic fear is that there's another technologically adept modern state in the region that is willing to support the Palestinians and maybe keep Arab hopes alive of some sort of settlement of that issue. And Iran would fit the bill, but Iran is far away and Iran is interested in other things. But I think Israel's main strategic goal is to keep Iran isolated, perhaps to have it bombed, and certainly to prevent any rapprochement between the United States and Iran. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of sort of think tanks and diplomatic energy and, you know, magazines and sort of support groups on Capitol Hill, which goes to try to, you know, keep Iran as a demon alive in the American consciousness.
Do you want to give odds on the chances for the final nuclear deal this fall?
Yeah, my odds would be like 1 in 3, but a 3 in 5 of an extension, and that both sides are willing to kind of live to keep kind of extending the current deal. Which
I'll settle for that. Yeah, I like
that. Well, it's better, you know, the thing is that only lasts as long as, say, Obama's president, and say it's better to have a deal in place in case there's a new hawkish president, like, which is, you know, reasonably right. Possible.
Now, is there much of a fight in the establishment over whether we should do this or not? Because it seems to be that even though the nuclear weapons issue is a big fake issue, it is the largest outstanding issue between us. Not that this has to be a great step toward peace, but it could be a little one. And it seems like, you know, either the establishment has decided they like that policy of the president or they don't. Is it just the neocons on the outs on this, or is it all
the
messy?
It's the neocons in Congress. I think there's to the extent there's a foreign policy establishment, it wants some sort of detente with Iran, meaning like top military, State Department officials, CIA officials probably do, the permanent government. But Congress, you know, probably does not. I mean, Congress is jumps much more to, you know, quote, campaign funds and Israel, essentially. So they're likely to be, I mean, they've already shown skepticism about Iran, Obama's deal,
right.
And may be able to put in some sort of enough poison pills and stuff to stop it. And, you know, Iran wants what it can get, too, so I'm sure they're not the easiest people to come to an arrangement with.
Right, yeah, that's probably true. All right, well, thanks very much for your time. Great to talk to you again, Scott.
Take care.
That's Scott McConnell, y'all. He's at the American Conservative magazine, The Middle East Doesn't Matter, Spotlight today on antiwar.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin.
Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. This is the Scott Horton Show. And so here, let's talk about the Korean thing a minute. I mentioned this yesterday. Oh, it's Jeff Stein. Man, I guess I probably could have had him on. Well, it's just to talk about a book excerpt, so I don't know. I guess not. But anyway, so Leon Panetta has written a book, and it says a bunch of things in it. I don't read those, man, the memoirs of these pigs. But different parts are making the news. And part of what he said was, if North Korea, this is the former Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, if North Korea moved across the border, our war plan calls for the senior American general on the peninsula to take command of all U.S. and South Korean forces and defend South Korea, including by the use of nuclear weapons, if necessary. Panetta writes in Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership and peace. So now the thing of that is, I guess he does tack on if necessary there, but... Well, he continues, I left the meeting with the powerful sense that war in that region was neither hypothetical nor remote, but ever present and imminent. Well, how about ever present and remote? Can we have that? An indefinite stalemate that, hey, could be a lot worse? What the hell's imminent about it? But anyway, you know, language with these people, it's mostly just a tool for confusion rather than actually getting across ideas, so you never really know what they mean because they don't know how to use words right. Not that I got the greatest vocabulary, but at least I don't get everything all twisted and say imminent means, well, whoever I kill, they were imminent. How do you like that? That's the... Read all about Terror Tuesday in the New York Times and read Obama's men explain that that's their definition of imminent is anyone they kill. Everyone they kill is a militant. Everyone they kill was going to do something at some point, possibly. And that's what imminent means. It means the guilt of those we murder. Anyway, so... Nobody really knows what the hell he's talking about other than, oh, yeah, you know, there might be a nuclear exchange here. And, of course, he doesn't continue, as Justin Romano pointed out in his article at antiwar.com the other day, he doesn't continue that, well, and then I said to the general, what are you kidding me? No, dude, you call home before you use nuclear weapons. You do not have the authority to use nuclear weapons. What is this, DEFCON 1? For Christ's sake. There's no pushback described by the Secretary of Defense here, and I guess we're left with the impression that he just went, wow, woo-wee, and kind of whistled and put his thumbs in his pockets and went on about his way, you know? If you can picture Leon Panetta, you get the scene. He's kind of a walking political cartoon in a way, ain't he? And then so, but then the point being that, man, these guys really, they just don't even still, after all this time, after the Cold War with Russia has been over for 35 years, 40 years, since the with China. Did I say Russia? With China. The Cold War with China has been over. Did I say Russia? Cold War with China has been over for 40 years. The Cold War with Russia has been over for 25. I know what the names of the different countries are. I just sometimes ain't talking good when I try to... But anyway, yeah, when there is no Cold War, these guys are still on this kind of hair trigger on the Korean Peninsula. And can't you just see it like straight out of Dr. Strangelove, right? Like any of these men stop and think for a moment about, oh, the humanity of you're going to use nuclear weapons. And when we know the North Koreans have nukes, too. They haven't been very good at exploding them so far in their tests, I'll concede. But they have apparently been able to achieve some fission. I don't know exactly how they could deliver their nukes and really how big they are. No one knows that much about their nukes. But apparently they are plutonium implosion nukes, which means they could be miniaturized and delivered even perhaps via artillery or a flatbed truck. I don't know. Anyway, even just a nuke on the DMZ fired by the North Koreans would be an absolute disaster. But then what's America going to do? They're going to nuke all the artillery on the northern side? Is that how they're... That's their plan for taking out the artillery? Is that it? Not conventional bunker buster bombs. But they're going to use nukes to take out those hardened artillery? Or they're going to nuke Pyongyang? Is that it? These people... this is the mindset. It really is the mindset of the state. And, you know, you ought to read some Daniel Ellsberg on nuclear weapons, man. He wrote a four-part series for truthdig.org all about nuclear weapons and how he was part of nuclear war planning. I mean, that was Dan Ellsberg. The reason he leaked the Pentagon Papers is because he was one of these guys, man. He had access. He and Leslie Gelb helped write them. His father helped design the atom bomb factory, but refused to participate in designing the H-bomb factory. Ellsberg knew he participated in this planning, and he reproduces the paperwork where the generals, and you know how generals write, I mean, they're not, their documents, the writing is no more sophisticated than like a fifth grade essay, right? It's all just like sentence fragments and crap and government speak and this and that, and there's no room in it for, you know, anything beyond information, usually nothing more than just raw data, you know, and then information, certainly no knowledge or wisdom or real context or explanation in any of these things. Just, you know, reassure the civilians that only a few hundred million people would die in the first weeks of a nuclear exchange with the Russians. And then, yes, possibly as many as a few billion by the end of a couple of years from now. And then, wait, what? And back then, there were only a few billion people in the world. What are they talking about? A billion or two? How many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of people are expected to die in a war with Russia? And yet to these guys, this is just paper in a notebook. Plan F for, you know, if something happens at the DMC, we go to plan F. And at the bottom is including the use of nukes, and then you just do it. And, you know, I don't know. I need to learn a lot more about that. I was under the impression that Bush Sr. had taken the nukes out of South Korea and they hadn't been put back. But what the hell do I know? Maybe Rumsfeld put them back. And maybe they're just talking about they launched stealth bombers from Missouri or from Guam or something like that, I guess, from Japan. I don't know. But anyway, it just goes to show how, you know, as Justin Raimondo put it in his article, they're madmen. You see, when you're a kid, you're brought up where this is just the world that you live in, and they show you pictures of men dressed up in olive green who went to fight Hitler and the Nazis during World War II, and you just get the idea that this government, this great organizing force among us is justice, is doing the right thing. If they've got an arsenal of nukes, then it must be because it's the right thing. And if they nuked the Japanese before, it must be because it's the right thing. And just, it all seems so just status quo to people until you stop for a second. Just 1 second and say, hey, wait a minute. Maybe Leon Panetta and all of his associates are raving psychopaths. And maybe even the possibility of splitting and or fusing atoms together in a war with North Korea ought to be absolutely off the table of the slightest possibility in a million years. Even if the North nukes the South. America's then going to nuke the slave population of North Korea to death for being, what, collectively guilty that they can't get rid of Kim Jong-un and his sister and their generals? Going to use nukes on them? Even if they did start it, and even if they did use nukes. It's madness, but... Oh, well, you know, that's just another day on the radio. That's just another day in print. That's just another paragraph in a memoir by a Secretary of Defense that, here, he's the new guy at the Secretary of Defense. Military's letting him know how it goes. Oh, yeah, we got authority to use nuclear weapons in the war. Wait, what? Did anybody follow up on this? I really should have got Jeff Stein on this. So what was the White House's response to this? Is that true? That battlefield commanders have authority to deploy nuclear weapons without calling back home first? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group.
I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there.
Well, I know if I get sick, I'm going to Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. They'll take good care of you.
Oh, you've got Ebola? Please, puke all over everyone in the waiting room.
Take crap on the floor. We'll all clean it up with our bare hands and then go eat lunch. They're doing a great job over there. Great job. It's the Scott Horton Show. And I almost forgot. I almost completely blew it. I got a letter saying, God dang, Mitchell Prothero, I don't like this guy, and you keep interviewing him and all the things that he says I ain't like. And I understand. So, who's Mitchell Prothero? Mitch Prothero, he's a reporter for McClatchy, D.C., and I've taken to interviewing him on the show since this spring, I guess shortly before Mosul fell is when I started talking to him, earlier this year. He's McClatchy's guy in Irbil. And no, he's not a libertarian. He's not a peacenik. He's a reporter. And in fact, you know, he doesn't seem like very right-wing to me, very warmongery to me, or any kind of thing like that, just because he's not any kind of libertarian or pure anti-interventionist. He doesn't seem to really have much of a bone to pick. He seems to really follow that reporter ethos of just, hey, trying to tell you the best I know the facts, and that's kind of just, you know, his role. And I think that, so he and I got into an argument on the show last week. What happened was I was saying, yeah, but when Biden names all these countries that are our allied states that have been financing ISIS and Nusra and the revolution in Syria this whole time, he forgot to name himself and the U.S. government, who's been helping to coordinate this all along, right? The CIA, this is America's satellite states. And Prothero said, no way, man, you're just wrong about that. They're not our satellites. They're our supposed allies, but they do whatever the hell they want, and whatever the hell they want is not necessarily what it is our government wants. And I'm putting words in his mouth now, but this is, you know, more or less the argument that he's making, is that Obama got cold feet about this whole support the revolution thing. It became very clear to him very quickly, because it was, hey, it was in McClatchy newspapers. It was way back when. They, as soon as al-Nusra really popped up, as he said, they put him on the terrorist list. And Obama knew that really, and because look, this is all personal. And Obama doesn't want to be the president that backed al-Qaeda in Syria. Even if all the politics are back al-Qaeda in Syria because that's what Israel wants to weaken Iran and Assad and Hezbollah, still, if you were Obama, would you really go full scale for that? So what they do, they... It's not that they didn't do it. It's that they did a real half-assed job, pretty much, right? They mostly looked the other way. Obama painted himself into a corner by saying red line if Assad uses any chemical weapons. So al-Nusra did a false flag attack and tried to blame it on Assad. And it's true that Obama sort of kind of tried to lie us into war on that a year ago. But then what'd he do? He backed down. And it was so obvious he didn't really want to do it all along. Damn red line statement. And so he threw it to Congress. And not only did he throw it to Congress, he specifically said out loud, like he didn't say this just in a phone call to Harry Reid and John Boehner. He said it, you know, the White House statement was go ahead and make it a conscience vote, which means feel free to vote no, which means he's explicitly telling the party leadership, I don't need you to crack the whip on your people and make them support this. By all means, go ahead and don't. I mean, come on. Please shoot me down on this. And as Ray McGovern has said, I think he's right, that really the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff really undercut the thing more than anything else by going out and saying, I don't see the hurry. I don't know why we got to do this now. Ask Obama. So Obama didn't want to get out ahead of the, or at least he figured he had his right flank covered by, and maybe he was afraid of getting out ahead of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on it in case he was going to get backstabbed for overthrowing Assad for the benefit of Baghdadi. And so he backed down. He didn't do it. I mean, it was a miracle. And yes, the American people were against it and did a lot to stop him too, but it was a coalition. But I think his heart wasn't really in it or he would have done it. He can do what he wants. He's a freaking president. And so anyway, it's all this stuff is so easy to boil down, but a lot of it doesn't boil down. You know, yes, Saudi and Qatar and Turkey are America's allies. Do they do everything that they're told? No. Did Obama really try to order them to stop? No. But then again, did Obama send a lot of weapons to these guys to really win the war? Did he really arm them up? Did he train them by the thousands? Did he do what the Israelis wanted? What the Turks and the Saudis wanted? Did he create a no-fly zone, a giant buffer zone that the Turks are still calling for to this day? He hasn't done that in 3 years. Now, it's certainly true, and I've accused him all along because, responsibility is just a concept, so it depends exactly how you mean it, but because of politics and because of direct support for the FSA and because of not demanding that the Gulf states and the Turks stop, that basically is still all his responsibility. You know what I mean? It might as well have all been a CIA job this whole time, since he could have stopped it if he'd really tried. And since a lot of the arms and trucks and money and food and supplies and other things and training and men that they've given the FSA have gone over to ISIS and al-Nusra, our enemies anyway. So the whole thing has been an absolute disaster. It's a complete disaster. But I guess, so maybe I'm trying to split the difference really between the way I maybe oversimplified it to Prothero and the way maybe he oversimplified it in disputing it and saying that, you know, these guys really do what they want. If I remember right, when I said, yeah, but Obama didn't really demand they stop, he certainly didn't threaten them with any consequences, that kind of thing. I don't think he had much of an answer for that, but I think he's probably right, and we would all be wise to recognize that just because America supports every potentate in the region doesn't mean that they necessarily always do what they're told. And I think this is one of the few places where Obama's cowardice has served us well. If he had been a real man about it, he would have done what Hillary Clinton wanted him to do back in 2012, which was go ahead and really back the rebels, and including sending in special forces and spies and as much money and weapons as it took to overthrow Assad and then supposedly, presumably, limit the suicide bomber kooks somehow, even though the whole damn rebellion belonged to them then. Obama resisted that. And when she left office, the first thing she did was go tattletale on him to the New York Times. Yeah, me and Petraeus and Panetta, we really wanted to back the rebels and build up a whole thing. And yet, Obama the coward wouldn't do it. And, you know, anyway, you know me, I'm not like singing Obama's song or justifying him or anything. I'm really still just talking about Prothero and how, I think probably I overstated it, which was why it was easy for him to duck the truth of it. That's in there somewhere. And yes, it's true, as my emailer friend writes here, that, you know, Obama could tell the Saudis, the Qataris, the Bahrainis, and whoever, well, screw you, no aid for you. You know, forget you, no more secret, sweetheart deals and this and that for you. But he's certainly nowhere willing to actually threaten them with consequences. I'm unaware of any real effort to really make them stop financing these guys. Not to maybe all directly to ISIS, but to the various groups, al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham, especially the Islamic Front and all them. Only this spring, really only this year, when things have blown up in their face so freaking bad. I guess maybe somewhat before Mosul fell, but mostly after. They finally said, okay, we got to insist now. So, but in other words, they could have done it all along. Just like there was a news story the other day. Obama considers going ahead and unilaterally closing Gitmo anyway. And I saw someone on Twitter said he could do that? Yeah, he could do that. You know, he's a president. He can move those troops. He could do it if he really wanted to. That kind of thing. And then, and now, as far as the Kurds are our only true allies in Iraq, I think that's pretty much true. I don't think he was arguing necessarily that America are the Kurds' only true allies. As emailer points out, Chomsky correctly. See, like I was saying on the show earlier, Chomsky pointed out all through the 90s that Bill Clinton was paying the Turks and arming the Turks to kill the Kurds all through the Clinton years. And so, no, America stabbed the damn Kurds in the back over and over again. In fact, the more loyal they are to us, the more danger they put themselves in, as a matter of fact. But certainly they're our most reliable allies in Iraq right now. But what does that amount to? Not very much. But anyway, I still like that dude. He's broken a lot of really important stories on this war, including he was the first to report CIA, JSOC, SOCOM building up that so-called secret base up in Kurdistan, and quite a few others too. And so anyway, gotta go. I'm out of time. I'd talk more, but see you tomorrow.